Welcome to Mac and Blue, where we introduce you to who is building Arizona, bringing you the people and businesses that shape the landscape around us. From economic development and developers, underwriters and lenders, architects and engineers, to the very builders and suppliers that bring it all together. Now let's join our hosts, Robert Johnson and JJ Levinsky, aka Mac and Blue.
Welcome to Mac and Blue. I'm Robert Johnson, Vice President of Torrey Contracting. Wait, I did it again. Vice President of Business Development at Torrey Contracting. And this guy, who is just laughing hysterically here.
Because I can.
Right, and because you care, is JJ Levinsky. He's the president of Blue Wave General Contracting.
I'm glad your memory out kicked in there and you
Well, you know, been a long day.
That sometimers turns into Alzheimer's turns
That's right.
into, but we're still here.
Yeah. How are you doing? Are you doing okay?
Yeah, I'm with you, right?
So yeah,
life's better.
Yeah, I'm checking out for the holidays.
Yeah.
Hey, how about our guest here?
Oh, yeah, that's right. We have a guest.
Yeah, we got somebody here with us today. Anyway.
The esteemed Carl Oberg.
Esteemed.
With Ardura Group.
Mm-hmm.
But I only know you with RPA, Ritak Paul and Associates. So thanks, Carl, for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And boy, you know, you've been around, you're kind of leader in the civil side and all those other, and you do some other crazy things too. So if you don't mind, give the audience, I know you've been on Geoholics podcast and they were just on ours not too long ago too. So, but for the audience sake, give us a little background of you and this crazy journey you've been on with all the different companies you had and the success you've had too.
Oh man. So now you're laying it on deep and I got to figure it all out. So you know, earlier there, Robert, it seemed like you're having a little bit of brain fog. So
yeah,
I'm going to have some brain fog myself.
No, it was brain fog. All right.
Yeah. More brain like brain fog. Fart and fog. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Well, I was like looking for the shots of tequila and all I found was these mirrors.
Yeah.
And I was like, it got me all excited there for a second, but
yeah.
So yeah, no, I'm Carl Oberg. I'm actually like fifth generation Arizonan, actually fifth generation Flagstaffian.
Fifth Whoa. Generation?
Yeah.
Didn't know Flag was that old.
Yeah, right. Actually, maybe my great grandparents there were before it became a town or a city, right? But wow. So yeah, grew up there.
Wow.
One of the places, I actually grew up all over the place, but Flagstaff was always hometown. Went to college up there as well, NAU. I worked construction with my stepdad at the time, Bob Delagowski, and we did a lot of really cool projects, a lot of custom homes and some couple motels and hotels and Holiday Inns and stuff. So, but one of the things I learned about Bob Delagowski was he was wicked smart, like Mensa smart. Guy served a few tours in Vietnam, and you know, he was like in special forces and just crazy, but I had to become a civil engineer so I could understand half the shit he told me.
Seriously.
Like, seriously. So, one of the things.
Was he your stepdad grow your entire like youth? Or
No.
Okay.
Only from like 14 until 18 or something.
Okay, so it was later in life, you know, as far as a teenager goes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity.
No, I had a lot of stepdads. So,
oh, yeah, got it.
I moved around quite a bit. But no, actually, I became a civil engineer out of spite. But being a civil engineer was great because I could actually understand my stepdad, Bob. When we were, you know, he's talking about cantilevers and fulcrum points, and he's talking about, you know, load bearing walls. And we'd go all the way through soil conditions to, you know, just barometric pressure when to replace glass in certain homes. So it was pretty interesting. Yeah. So when I graduated from NAU, mm-hmm. it was in the early 90s. Growing up in construction, the late 80s and early 90s, we went through another recession.
Right.
I don't know if you guys remember. It was like 17% interest yep. rates on homes mm-hmm. and stuff. So it was tough. And when I graduated college, Bob said, well, you know, why don't you just continue doing what we're doing? I said, nah, I want something a little more recession-proof. Well, even engineering is not recession-proof.
Right, right.
So I moved down to Phoenix when I graduated from NAU in 1994, kicking and screaming because as you grow up in Flagstaff, Phoenix at that time was the armpit of the devil itself. But guess what, man? I love Phoenix. I love it. And moving down here, I started working for a company called HNTB, and And they closed their doors here, and I went over to a couple other firms and stuff. And in 2004, I got an opportunity to actually to take over RPA, not buy it, but they were giving it to me. John Rittock and Rick Powell, I ran into them in 2004 at a Roads and Streets conference, and they said, you know, everybody was asking me if I would jump Parsons Transportation Group, asked if I'd like run their roadway groups and stuff. And I was standing in line getting a beer, and John Rittock was in front of me, and he said, why don't you just come take over our company? And I thought he was joking. So he bought me a beer, which if anybody knows John Rittock, he's the super cheap guy.
That's serious.
Yeah, yeah. But he's awesome. Like, he's frugal.
It was like, here's the mortgage, here's the deed to the house.
But no, he's frugal. I should not say cheap. He's an amazing man, by the way. And we just started talking, and I said, you know, I can't have you like give me the company. So we kind of did a guesstimate of what we thought it was worth, and I paid him and Rick. You know, a certain amount of money, and I also borrowed cash from them so that I could maintain payroll and everything. And they were such amazing people to work with. Ricky Powell, he passed away not too long ago, but just a great engineer to learn from. And I was employee number 7, and 2 of them were retiring, Rick Powell and John Rittock. And then I just took it my own direction. And
how long did that transition last, Carl? Like with them still being around?
Oh, well, you know, I needed them around for at least a couple years because, first of all, in engineering and even construction, nobody teaches you business.
No.
Like, I don't remember a single business class. Heck, I barely remember English classes, right? So, you know, I needed to lean on John Rittock and definitely Rick Powell with his technical capabilities as much as I could. And it was cool because they hung around and held my hand. And I remember when their last day, I was just like freaked out. Like, okay, what am I going
to
do?
Like, you have the keys to the kingdom now.
Yeah, what if I have a question? You know, will they answer my phone calls? And it was pretty intense, actually. I was like, what am I doing? How come am I that stupid? You know, I always take risks, and I took this. This was a huge risk. We had to sell our house, so we had enough money to do this and that. We bought another house. It was a total fixer-upper. I mean, I overdid it. Found out my wife was pregnant right after we did that.
Oh, no.
And she's quitting her job. I'm like, oh, wah! But we prevailed, and it was fun. So we grew the company quite a bit. We did some more mergers and acquisitions ourselves. And then about a year ago, I was approached by a private equity group and another firm, Ardora, and they said all the right things. And it's been amazing. It's just been an amazing ride, actually. So still the same Carl Oberg.
Right.
Just instead of president CEO or principal CEO, I'm now just a mountain region director. So, yeah, which is great. So,
what, for the audience sake, explain the how does the relationship and the umbrella work right now?
So it's actually, there for the last couple of years, and anybody that owns an engineering or construction or architectural firm or surveying firm, you're getting calls left and right to sell your company. You know, and
everybody right now.
Oh, it's crazy. You know, it's crazy. By the way, if you ever want to sell your company, you sell it when times are great. You don't sell it when times are not great. So these folks, I met Ernesto Aguilar. He's the CEO for Ardora. And I don't know how he reached out to me, but
they're based where in Florida, right?
Yeah. Okay. Miami, Florida. And he reached out and said, hey, I'd like to talk to you. And I'm like, all right. I always tell my employees, I'm going to go on a little side note. Like, when somebody wants to try to hire an employee of yours and they want to interview them, I say you should always go for the interview because there's one of two things you're going to learn. the place you're talking to is better, or the place you're at is better. So you gotta do it.
50-50.
That's wisdom. That really is wisdom. And don't be afraid to let somebody go out there.
Yeah. Yak. Well, the last thing you want is an employee that's miserable working with you, because that's cancerous. Mm-hmm. So anyways, I always thought about that when people would ask, you know, are you interested in possibly selling? I would meet with everybody.
You'd say yes all the time.
All the time.
At least take the meeting.
You know why you take the meeting as well? Because you sign these things like, I'll look up your skirt if you look up mine. So you get to read all these things about other companies. You get to see like their financials and how they do things and stuff. And you have an NDA, so you can't steal people. You can't do this stuff. But it isn't the stealing the people.
Education.
It's the education. It's the knowledge. So anyways, going back to my meeting, Ernesto called me and said, hey, I'd like to meet with you or just talk to you on the phone or something. I'm like, sure. And I really liked him. He just had his attitude is very similar to mine. He's got the energy. He's like, you know, an entrepreneur, and he's, you know, more of a salesperson than an engineer, right? So we met on the phone, Teams meeting. And the one thing that I also learned, this might upset some of your listeners, but there's four types of ways you can sell your company. There's an internal sell. You sell it to the people, you know, you've groomed. The external sell has three different factors. You can either sell to another firm. And when you usually sell to another firm, it's like a third, a third, a third. Like, here, we'll give you, I'm going to buy your company for $100. I'll give you $30 now. I'll give you $30 in stock. And I'll give you, we'll give you the $40 over time. Then there's a venture capitalist. The venture capitalist, and forgive me if you're a venture capitalist, but most of my friends that have sold to venture capitalists or taken money from venture capitalists have lost their entire company and everything. Like the percentage of that doesn't seem to be right. Right? It's like really stacked in a venture capitalist favor. Then there's a thing called private equity. We call it PE, not just professional engineers, but private equity. Good friend of mine, his name's Matt Gawley. He was the president of F&F Construction. So I have a house down in Mexico. Matt's down there. He's got a house down in San Carlos by me. He's got this little tiny boat. It's like 74 feet long, and it says effing fun, right? And I'm all, Matt, I know you contractors make some good bank, man. You get some good profits, I guess. I said, but that's just ridiculous. And he goes, no, Carl, no, no. He goes, I bought that, but every time I sold my company, I bought a bigger boat. I'm like, wait a minute, what do you mean every time you sold your company? So he explained to me, private equity. I'm like, huh. He goes, private equity, they recapitalize every 4 to 5 years. And private equity, they don't run off the stock market. They don't run off of, public trade. They're a bunch of people that have money that want to make more money. Mm-hmm. So they hire these brilliant individuals. And all these private equity people I've ever met are just insanely brilliant, right? They know numbers. They can forecast. They can foresee. It's like they have like these little crystal balls and a crystal ball.
Yeah.
Sweaty. And they can see things that we can't see. So they don't lose money often. And every time you recapitalize, you resell those companies to another private equity group that wants to do something, or that existing private equity group will do it again. So you can get, 2, 2.5, 10 times what your original investment is. So when that happens, people, they make some money and stuff. So that's one of the reasons why I went with a private equity. So there was the four reasons I picked a PE. Or the four options, I picked the PE option. But Ernesto, the guy walks in, and his idea, which is one of the reasons why Ardora is one of the fastest growing engineering companies, is because we're buying small to medium sized firms. The idea is you're not buying just the people and the contracts. You're picking up the culture, and you're picking up the entrepreneurs that were successful at that. So we have these meetings. So our company has bought, I want to say like 28 other firms. And we have these strategic planning meetings, and it's so cool because you're sitting in a room
full of other
business people that are, engineers, surveyors, inspectors, and we all think outside the box. It's just really cool. Like, it's really, really cool. So being with your twin that thinks like you, or and then your triplet, and then your quintuplet and septuplet, and
yeah,
I mean, but the thing is sometimes we agree, but sometimes we don't. But it doesn't matter because all of us think outside the box, and it's fun. It's truly been amazing. And some people don't believe me, but I'm like, it's been amazing. It's been great.
So what is that? Now, we're connected on social media, so I see what you're doing all the time, and I know it's vice versa. But I've noticed your travel seems to take the personal travel out and more of the professional travel. Mm-hmm. Because of that involvement with them right now, it seems like you're more involved going around to these other places. Is it just business acquisition, or are you doing the culture development and all those kind of things too, Carl? What does that mean to the listener as far as like how's your role changed?
So what my role used to be is, you know, I had to try to just maintain projects and clients and contracts for my employees in Arizona.
Right.
Now I get to work we call it the mountain region. So we open up an office in Albuquerque. We purchased Woodson Engineering up in Flagstaff. We purchased Shepherd Westnitzer up in Flagstaff. And then we have all these offices in Prescott, Sedona, Cottonwood, Winslow, Flagstaff. You know, so we're trying to grow that. And I'm also set up an office in Reno. Mm. And we set up an office in Las Vegas. I'm about to set up an office in Colorado as well, so at Colorado Springs. So what I've been doing is more not just trying to win those single contracts, but I'm trying to build those relationships and trying to grow even more, because I ain't gonna lie, I got a lot of equity in Ardora. So the goal is in a recapitalization, I want to make that equity not 3x, but 13x.
Right.
So we want to grow, but we want to grow smart, and we want to grow with people we know. So a good example of that is Mark Woodson, owns Woodson Engineering up in Flagstaff. He was my first boss when I was in college at NAU. I actually interned. When I say first boss, I mean first boss in engineering. Interned at the city of Flagstaff, and he was the city engineer.
Oh. Hmm.
So he kind of saved me. He's a big reason. Another big reason I'm here, because I couldn't afford college one semester, and my professors didn't want me to drop out. So they worked a deal with Mark Woodson and the city of Flagstaff to create an intern program for me, and that I could work at, earn money to pay for the next semester.
That's a pretty cool story.
That was really cool. So Mark, you know, he did it. He liked it. And then my senior year of college, he was one of the teachers for the senior engineering design class. And so I would call him Doc, you know, like, what's up, Doc? And, you know, just over time, just known Mark Woodson, and I trust him. I believe in him. He's got great – his ethics are unbelievable, his work ethics and stuff, his personality, his reputation. So it made sense when I was purchased that I wanted to pursue him. So and then the same thing with Shepherd Westnitzer. Guillermo Cortez, him and I grew up together. You know, I grew up with his family, and we went to college together and stuff as well. And he's a brilliant entrepreneur. He's an outside-the-box thinker, and he's done a great job, him and Art Beckwith and John Westnitzer, on growing SWI. And there's all these other people that I grew up with that actually work at SWI and at Woodson. So it's like a family thing. And that's what I've been trying to do, is acquire some of these firms that I trust the owners. Mm-hmm. So that's one of my tasks now as a mountain regional director.
Did your own M&A then give you the catalyst to do that in this situation? Did it give you that? Well, I know it gave you the equity, but it also gave you I would think it'd give you a little pep in your step to go out and do that next level. Is that a fair assumption, Carl?
Oh, totally. Yeah. You know, once you learn something and you believe in it, it's easy to sell it.
Right.
You know, and, you know, this last year has been very tough. And when I say tough, like not in a hard to find work tough. We're going to talk about that in a second. Right. But it's been tough because there is such a demand in our industry, all of us, architects, contractors, I mean, all the whole breadth of it, the tradespeople, that in engineering, we were seeing an increase in salaries that are off the charts. It wasn't a linear increase. We're talking an exponential increase. And I'm sure you guys have seen it in the construction world, and it's hard to find people and stuff. One of the issues that we have is, like, in my company, Ritok Powell, and there's a bunch of other ones, this is a lot of our bread and butter comes from the government. I do a lot of private development type stuff, but I do mostly government. In engineering, and it's only in the United States, by the way, the rest of the countries don't, we are capped at what the government really wants to pay us in salaries.
Okay.
Okay.
Fair.
So, for example, I have 60-something on-call contracts with government agencies. So as my employees' rates are increasing and increasing and increasing— The margins are going down, 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 and we're busy. We're really busy, and you know, so it's tricky. It's very tricky. If you're a small to medium-sized firm, you know, to maintain those salaries to keep up with the other people— You're not gonna be paying your client to do the work.
Right.
Our insurance rates have gone through the roof. I mean, it's not fun. And when we try to sit there and work with other engineers and surveyors and inspectors to try to get some sort of basic hourly rates, then it's called collusion.
Right.
So it's like, what
damned
the F?
Damned if you do and damned if you don't, right?
Torrey Contracting, your full-service Division 9 contractor. Torrey Contracting operates with a smaller, hands-on team. This cohesive structure results in superior workmanship and economical solutions. We deliver projects with unsurpassed commitment to quality and stewardship of budget. Torrey Contracting, small enough to listen, big enough to deliver.
So, you know, and I've been talking to some of my friends that have their own engineering or you know, surveying or inspection or environmental firms, and the smaller folks, and it's hard to swallow that debt, or it's hard to swallow that, you know, you're not going to make the profit that you thought. A lot of people did see some great profit margins a couple of years ago, but it was this little thing called a PPP loan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, let's be honest. A lot of people, that helped a lot of people, and it shows up in your profit margin. So you sit there and go, man, I did great. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, when I talk to some of these folks, JJ, I explain this, and they explain it to me. Like, you know what? I don't know how we're going to survive. Because if I'm having to pay this individual X and the client will only allow me to invoice Y, you know, it doesn't make sense. And by the way, my overhead, my multiplier, all that's – my overhead's screaming up and my multiplier is screaming down. We seem to make it – like our goal is to have a 10% profit. We call it the fixed fee associated with government contracts. You have your FARS approved overhead rate and what I do, you know, on the government side. And by the way, that's usually negotiated down from what it really is. Like I could have a 200% overhead rate, but it's been negotiated down to 170. So you're already out 30%. And then
right.
You multiply that by your hourly rate and then you add your fixed fee, the profitability of 10%. You know, it's supposed to be good for everybody, but it's not for the engineering community. And I don't know how the architects are. I haven't talked to them about it. So it's a little different. And that's what I've been able to help, like with the acquisitions. You ask the question. But when I talk to these people, at least I know what I'm talking about. Then they know that I'm talking about the same thing they're talking about.
The same pain points.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have some of these younger engineers. And we're losing people right now because they're like, my work-life balance is crap.
Because it's so busy?
So busy.
Yeah.
And yeah. I said, what were you doing in 2008?
Yeah.
They're all, well, I was 10. I'm like, yeah. It was a lot different. Like, yeah. And I talked earlier about recession proof, where I was proved wrong. There is a recession. We are not recession proof. I said, it was terrible in 2008, 9, 10, 11. I said, we went from, you know, we went to half our staff. And I remember one year, you know, we won a little over $7 million worth of work, say. And another year, we won $1.1 million worth of work.
Wow.
So there was no raises being given. There was actually decreases in salaries. There weren't bonuses at that time. I mean, we watched so many people in our industry, in construction, surveying, architectural, leave our industry. And that's another reason why we're hurting now.
Sure.
Is because there's that whole 10-year gap that we got right now, so... Well, that seemed like a long-winded answer for that question.
No, it's cool.
But it was, yeah.
Don't just keep talking. It's good stuff.
Yeah, very good stuff.
Yeah. You got any questions?
No. I thought you were about to say something else.
No, you had just like...
I know. I was waiting for you to ask a question. It looked like you were ready to write
really
something down.
Cool cerebral look on your
phone
face.
My phone was ringing, and I was trying to...
It did.
On my watch and try to, you know, like, okay.
Honey, when are you going to be home?
This guy won't shut up.
Yeah, turn him off, man. Turn him off.
All right, Carl.
That's funny.
Going down a different rabbit hole for a little bit because I know you're open to this. You kind of got a cool personal story about where you live.
Where I live?
Yeah.
Like now?
Yeah.
Currently where
you
I
know,
live?
You know, in Phoenix.
Yeah.
Come on.
Downtown Phoenix?
Yeah, come on. Tell everyone the story.
Downtown Phoenix?
Well, wasn't it that you...
Yeah.
You literally couldn't afford a place, right. And you're down there. And plus, I've seen your pictures. You've been kind of remodeling
a little bit. Yeah. Like, isn't that what you always do? So, I think what you're talking about, JJ, because I have a ton of stories. I love storytelling. I love storytelling so much. I just bought a vehicle because it's called Storyteller. So I'm like, yeah.
Well, we can tell that one too.
Well, you bought a vehicle that's called Storyteller.
Yeah, it's like these little RV things.
Okay,
so
gotcha.
I can pull my cars and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's called Storyteller. And I was like, yeah. So back in 94,
yep.
We moved down here, as I mentioned, kicking and screaming. My wife followed me. She wasn't my wife at the time. She was.
He paid her well.
Yeah,
she followed me.
I was all, "Hey, baby, you should follow me to Phoenix, the armpit of the devil itself." She was all in on that one. No, she ended up transferring, going to ASU. So we were living there, and I had goals in my life. One of my goals was to graduate college. Mm-hmm. I put myself through school. Mm-hmm. Nobody helped me. My second one was to buy my own home. And the third one was to find an individual that I could spend the rest of my life with. So I graduated college. Number two on my list was to buy a home. And I was looking and looking. I mean, I wasn't making that much. I was making like $25,000 a year back in the early 90s. But we had some friends that lived in downtown Phoenix. And there was this house a couple doors down. It was a little tiny house. But it was for sale. And I made a crazy offer, like 64 grand or whatever, and the lady accepted it. And the reason why we bought in down, and everybody thought I was crazy, because if anybody from Phoenix area remembers, you didn't live in downtown Phoenix back then. I mean, it was crazy, dangerous, and I mean, I could have a whole another session with you guys and stories just about that. So we bought, and everybody thought we were nuts. Said, "What are you doing? Why are you going down there? Do you realize?" And I'm like, it was literally the only place we could afford to buy a house. It was in downtown Phoenix.
Right.
I could count on one hand, and, you know, the FQ story, Roosevelt, Willow was kind of coming up and going, you know, coming up at that time. But, you know, all these other little neighborhoods down there, I could count on one hand the nice houses. I mean, exclude Encanto Palm Crop.
True.
Great neighborhood, by the way. Now I can count on those same neighborhoods, one hand, the houses that need to be, you know, improved. I
mean,
they've all been redone. Yeah. And it's just been amazing to see that and to see what's going on in downtown.
Yeah.
Downtown Phoenix has become a hot spot. Like, it is awesome to be down there. And our office right now is in the middle of the hottest of the hottest, and we just love it.
Because you guys moved, what, Did you move?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like we a moved year ago or so?
2 years ago now. 2 years ago. Yeah. Okay. November would be our second year. Yeah, we moved to the old ADEQ building on the northeast corner of Roosevelt and Central. So we have the top floor, and it's just so cool because we look out the floor at all different windows, and you see our projects, and it's really cool. But we have a problem, though, and it's become a really big problem. I got to really talk about this, actually, because just thinking about downtown, a friend of mine, his name's Matt Fulton. He owns all these things called the Whining Pigs and Pigtails.
Yeah.
He built this bar restaurant in the basement of our building called Rough Rider. Ugh, he's such a jerk. Because we're all down there all the time. Like when clients come over, like, JJ, you want to come visit me or Robert? And you're like, hey, can we go to Rough Rider? Literally, that place has made me gain like 10, 15 pounds, and I'm this much closer to being an alcoholic. That's our problem. And these guys are just building more and more great restaurants and bars. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. Just all my employees are coming in drunk and stuff. No, just kidding. That I know.
It's funny because I see you, you know, again, just because we're connected, it's almost like you're a foodie expert now all the time. I'm like, wow, Carl's here and Carl's here. It's like, wow, he's having the time of his life.
Oh,
but the transformation down there, I think it's a great story.
Yeah. You know? It's fun. And
now
our
you,
house.
And now you also, I think you've made some comments before about how if this is the right, how community focused it is too, right? Like like you're part of a neighborhood.
Totally. So, you know, there's so many different neighborhoods down there. Like our neighborhood in the Roosevelt, historic Roosevelt neighborhood, we have a group called the Roosevelt Action Association. So, and I've been a member of that, actually was a president of that once. FQ Story has neighborhood, you know, folks that oversee that neighborhood. It's not HOA. It's just these groups that just want to be better. And I'm actually a past president of that neighborhood. And then there's the Grand Avenue Merchants Association, GAMA. I've been a big part of that. You know, the point is that there's so many little communities inside this little bit bigger community that's still a very small community. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Downtown Phoenix Downtown Phoenix is a very small city. It really is. Yep. You're between the Sevens,
yep.
7th Street, 7th mm-hmm. Avenue. You go from, I don't know, Grant, you know, Lincoln, whatever, mm-hmm. all the way up north to Dunlap.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody
huge.
Knows the
Sunny
school.
Slope area yeah. up there, all that. Yeah.
Everybody, you know, you're with the Madison District or, you know, you all went to Arizona School of the Arts or you all went to, you know, it's just like, it just is amazing. And it's so small downtown and then the whole central, north central that, you know, I travel all over the world and I got my kids run into people all over the world.
Like
we're at a vacation somewhere and somebody walks by and goes, hey, James. And my son's all, hey, Ernie, or whatever, yeah. right? I'm like, are you kidding? It's just that small of a place. And you never think that when people say Phoenix. They think it's just this monster city. But there's all these pockets. You know, Ahwatukee has got the same stuff. And the Arcadia area up here. I mean, it's all – everybody knows everybody. And it's really cool. It's actually really, really cool.
You bilingual?
En Estados Unidos no hablamos. So
there you go.
My Spanish isn't as great as it was.
Well, the reason I ask is I know you talk about all your international travel. I see you down in Colombia and Puerto Rico, and of course you have a house in Mexico. Is that all just personal, or do you fold work into that as well?
A little of both. Colombia, because yeah, I'm.
You can't talk about the Columbia stuff.
That's all right.
Work. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I got to cut that. Yeah,
well, you're gonna lose, they made movies
you're
about
lose,
that.
You're gonna lose an arm. Yeah, I guess something
sorry,
big
Carl.
Yeah, anyway, go ahead.
You're talking about the drug smuggling.
Oh. Well, that reminds me, I have to go to the bathroom after this.
Yeah.
No. Colombia is actually a beautiful country, and it started out with trying to do work over there, trying to help. We've got a lobbyist friend of mine. His name is Mike Axelrod. He is very connected, and he was trying to help us land a couple big projects. One of them was El Campín, the FIFA football stadium
right.
there in Bogota. So he, you know, we started working on that during the recession. Ritok Powell and Associates, we took big pride in doing projects all over the world.
Oh,
that was one way we were able to maintain our employees and stuff, was because there wasn't so much going on here, mm-hmm. but we were able to do a couple hydro facilities in Rwanda, up in the Mosanze area, which is in the upper northwest by the Five Peaks and the Silverback Gorillas. Beautiful country. Highly recommend it. Then we did some stuff in Tanzania. Mm-hmm. We're flying to Dar es Salaam. We did some projects, like design concepts for like 8 more hydro facilities. And we even got involved in a company there because we went there for work, you know, for a project, but we came back with a purpose. So we started doing a lot of stuff there, like in Africa. And well, the same thing, it got word got out that we're not scared. So mm-hmm. next thing I know, I'm in like Papua New Guinea looking at stuff. I'm in Jamaica trying to look at stuff for them. You know, we're in and ended up in Colombia. So I'm a commissioner for the Phoenix Sister Cities. So one of the things we're trying to do, I don't know how much you guys know about the Sister Cities.
Keep going.
But the Taiwan Semiconductor, yep. the TSMC, that was a big part of some of our relationships with Taiwan. And, you know, we're trying to share resources. We're trying to share, you know, just knowledge and stuff. And we decided that we wanted to create a new city in Colombia. And Colombia is about to blow up in a great way. They've cleaned up everything. Their politics are not, you know, aren't as fragile as they used to be, you know, and they've got all kinds of great potential resources. So my job was to kind of help try to find a city to call a sister city. So we looked at a bunch of cities. And since I've already been in Colombia, I've been to Bogota, Medellin, I've been to Cartagena and stuff. You know, if I felt comfortable as being one of those folks. Mm-hmm. So me and a couple other commissioners, we went to check out Medellin on behalf of Mayor Kate Gallego and her staff. And it was the most amazing meeting or amazing time. It was business. I mean, in that kind of business, you're eating at really nice restaurants, you're having top shelf drinks, but I mean, it was meeting after meeting after meeting with all these delegates and stuff. But Medellin is beautiful, beautiful. I highly recommend traveling to Medellin. Puerto Rico is another one. You know, I went there on a political PAC for a friend of mine who's a congressional person. And we also have an office in Puerto Rico.
Oh.
Puerto Rico has been struggling because of all these – I mean, they had the hurricanes, but then I don't know if you guys recall, but there was a huge earthquake, mm-hmm. you know, in the southern part of the island. So we're trying to help them get everything back up into shape.
Carl, if I may, let's take a tangent for just a minute.
Tangent.
How was it your vision, risk-taking, someone else that worked with you – How did RPA, what was the catalyst for jumping into all this international stuff other than the recession? Like who took that leap of faith? Was it you?
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. But I also asked, you know, like my partners.
Okay.
Hey, you guys want to try this? And I mean, there was major risks, but there were some major rewards. And I will honestly say that the rewards were not as great as I wished they would be.
Okay.
Like we spent a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of money, and it really didn't pan out.
Okay.
But
fair statement.
As a business person, mm-hmm. that didn't pan out. As a person that loves people and loves, you know, everything about the world.
Places.
The culture, all that
everything
stuff.
Everything. Yeah. Like, so one of the things I do is I always get together with the different children of these, like, I want to call them villages.
Yeah.
And I make them put their arms up and I take photos with them and they will walk with me everywhere. And, you know, it's just the memories that we got from that will outweigh the money lost every day of the week. Mm-hmm. And when you have a village that is doing, the kids are doing their homework, and these kids want school so bad that they're willing to walk a couple miles every day, one direction each day.
Uphill, barefooted in
the snow. Barefoot in the snow. Yeah. be surprised. Yeah, in Ringe area has snow all over it.
Yeah.
It doesn't. But, you know, when they're doing their homework and with char or kerosene and, you know, or the fathers, and, this is going to sound very crappy here, but we found that if we were able to do something with the men to keep them occupied and busy, like my one business partner has a mine. So what he found is he would put a TV in and he was running off of solar and everything. And then he got, you know, was able to get news, a news station that in the morning, all of his employees would be get there early because they want to be connected to the rest of the world. They would work. And then after work, they would still stay there and like watch games or listen to the news versus when he didn't do that, a lot of his employees wouldn't show up because they were hungover or whatever. We found that physical abuse based off of alcoholism or drug usage in these villages was astronomical. So the husband's bored, and again, it sounds like I'm, but I'm not.
But they have nothing else to do.
They didn't have anything to do.
You're giving the facts.
It's dark outside, you know, while that person, the husband's trying to do, you know, working on the mines or do whatever. The wife is trying to get the food going. They don't have refrigeration, so they're planning things a certain way. So you harvest it. When an animal is butchered, they use everything, and they have to do something with it. You know what I'm saying? So, but the husbands would just, they're bored, and they would drink banana beer, or they'd make whatever. They'd find alcohol, and then they would literally, like, you'd see the abuse. So our goal was if you can get a light bulb, you know, for the kids to at least do their homework. And then, you know, they can even have a switch, you know, to plug their cell phones in. And by the way, I get better cell service in the middle of Tanzania.
Oh, come on.
Than I do in downtown Phoenix.
Come on.
Guarantee it. Ask anybody who's gone. You would be shocked at how well your cell service is in the middle of nowhere in the bush. You're like, oh, wow. So when I see these movies, like, oh, I have no cell service. I'm like, bullshit. Bullshit. You have awesome cell service. So we had this village, a little over 600 homes we're going to electrify. We're going to, for 25,000 shillings, which is like nothing, we put a switch in, a light bulb, and a recip, you know, which is cheap. So when these villagers found out that we were doing this, by the way, they don't have AC.
Right.
They don't have a freezer. They don't have, you know, anything of power. You know, some of them would put their little solar panels and charge their phones. What do you think was the number one item these people bought when they found out? Televisions.
There comes a time when dreams become a reality, when you see your vision materialize into a true work of art. And the only way to get there is to choose a general contractor who shares that same vision and knows how to bring it to life. At Blue Wave, we aren't so big that we've forgotten where we've come from, and we aren't so small that we can't care for your projects regardless of their size. When your vision deserves safety, perfection, timeliness, and expertise in order to become a reality, trust Blue Wave to get it done right the first time.
Flat screen televisions. And we're like, well, hell, you know, we're entrepreneurs and we think outside the box. And now we're like, we better get some cable. We better get some satellite dishes, you know, that type of stuff. But number one thing, not anything else.
Well, I think it goes back to they wanted to be connected.
They want to be connected. They want to be connected because they feel like they're so far behind. So, it started out as a project through UTS or USTDA, United States Trade and Development Effort. No, that's USTDE. What was the A? Anyways, it was a program started by the Bush administration, and then Obama took it to another level, which was fantastic. They were trying to get funds out there so you can help some of these communities, and the goal was it's all American. So, you know, it was a really cool little program. And we were the only ones in that program that actually designed and had built a facility that was functional and really helped a community amazingly. But, you know, the federal government and their glory, they screwed that whole system up. So whatever.
No shocker there.
So once we did that and word got out, we were getting invited everywhere. Pete Hemingway, one of my partners, him and I feel like we traveled all over the world and with these opportunities to help these communities. And that was, I think we were more into that than we were into trying to make the money, even though we thought in our heads we were going to make money, profit, and we lost our asses. But it was worth it. It was so worth it. I'd do it again.
Yeah, but look at what all you've experienced, the connections made.
Oh, it was awesome. No, and just the people.
Don't you think you're a better entrepreneur because of it?
I think I'm a better entrepreneur because of everything. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. I think I'm one of those individuals, and you know, right now I'm being narcissistic, I'm sure. But I feel like everything I do, I turn around and see every day, helps me be a better person.
Right.
And if I could be a better person and kind of share that, that's even better. People in this world seem to get greedy. And what they don't realize, and maybe they do, is that when you die, you can't take it with you. The only thing you can take with you is your reputation, your integrity. Mm-hmm. The people in this world, if we can figure out how everybody needs to go in a direction that when they die, people come to their funeral or their, you know, with me, it would be a celebration life. But I want people to go to my children and go, your dad was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Because that's all you got. But people forget about that. So yes, a lot of the experiences that I've got and the experiences that I'm learning as an entrepreneur, it just builds that character, in my opinion, to be a better person, to help do better things. Because
how do we impart that into this world that we started all this conversation with about? You learn how to build, you learn how to nail, you learn how to do all that, but nobody teaches you business. How do we make that leap with these experiences?
Oh my gosh. You know, I think we got to start teaching people again not to think about them. It's not a me world, an I world.
Yeah, it has become very much about.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what you see. And this is my opinion, by the way. And you guys might get beat up on this one as well. Okay. There's a few things I'm saying.
Last time I checked, it is our podcast.
Yeah, right? We can say what we want. And therefore, you can say anything you want.
We give you permission, Carl.
I just feel like there's a lot of in the United States, I see it. And it's getting worse. Is that there's a lot of – it's all about the me game. Mm-hmm. It's the me game. And if we could try to put something in people's head – and not preach, you know, not do a religious enactment of some sort. But, I mean, it's like you almost have to have these really bad things happen in our world for people to come together.
9/11.
Yeah, unfortunately, it takes, you know, things something like that. Yeah.
Pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's – it's very unfortunate, you know, when you know, you see these hurricanes destroy things or a typhoon or whatever. You know what I mean? Then we all gather to help. And then we forget. It's like we forget. If you remember 9/11, there prior to 2001, it was getting ugly. People were not nice. People were being mean to each other. 9/11 hit, and we all freaking held hands and sang kumbaya.
And everybody was like, man, humans can be a really amazing species, and da-da-da-da, and you forget everything.
And you forget. And then this thing called the recession hit. Mm-hmm. And we watched our children went to a pretty decent school, expensive school. But we watched some of these families that had everything all of a sudden have nothing, you know? And people came out of the woodwork to help everybody, you know, in the Great Recession is what I call it. And then we started being jerks again. Mm-hmm. Then we had this thing called the pandemic, and we're all trying to help each other and stuff. And now we're becoming jerks again. So I feel like we always have to have something bad to make us all love each other.
We have to have the jerk moments to appreciate.
So maybe
them.
That's the yin and the yang. You got to have the crap to have the love. And that's something we got to get over. I think if we can try to even overcome that from a 50-50 perspective, if you have the 50% yin and the 50% yang, maybe if we could do like a start with a 40% yin and a 60% yang,
yeah.
You know, but I see it. I see it like with clients, you know, it's like, I need my job, you know, like I get it. I know. But there's I'm doing a school over here for these orphans. Can you help me out a little bit? Or, you know, yeah. I don't know. But that wasn't a very good analogy. But, you know, that's I don't know. I don't know, Robert, what the answer is to that. If you can figure that out, your podcast will go.
Yeah. There's the $1 million answer right there. Yeah.
I think of Dave Ramsey. Better not to be. You know, mm-hmm. He created a system based off of what happened from the recession of a cash-only system, mm-hmm. right? System, you know, society. You know how many listeners that guy has? And how many people follow it? Because they're learning the financial.
None of us learned. I mean, no. I was like, you know.
No, right?
Back to what you were saying, Carl. They didn't teach us business at business school.
No, and I wish they did, but there's something going on right now. It's called the financial capabilities is gone. So there's a big issue going on in schools on how to teach kids about finances.
Balancing checkbooks and stuff that, like, what do you mean? What's a
we
checkbook?
Did that when I was in school. Yeah. We learned all that stuff. Yep. We learned like money in mm-hmm. equals money out. Mm-hmm. If money in is greater than money out, you're going to have a great retirement. If money in is less than money mm-hmm. out, you're going to be in trouble. Well, I mean, we got to teach that. Mm-hmm. Why can't we also, as we're teaching financial responsibility, we teach responsibility amongst other people?
Yeah, you would think it would be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, that easy.
But, so if you can figure out how to Dave Ramsey that bad boy with positive thoughts.
I'll work on
positive thoughts by Robert.
That's your assignment, Johnson. Robert.
That's it. Better than I deserve.
Better than I deserve.
Carl, come on. You got other stuff. What
have we not asked you that we should ask you or you want us to ask you?
So I'm going to be about me here for a second, but about me for what I do for the community.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So one of my biggest things that I enjoy doing, I don't hate it, I actually love it, is I do a lot with mental health, mm-hmm. mental illness, mental disorder, okay. All right? And I can start spewing some major numbers out there, but I wanted to create a nonprofit utilizing a bunch of psychiatrists, not psychologists, into helping some of the folks that are in the transient community more or less to help them get over certain things. So, you know, addictions, mm-hmm. you know, some of the items that are preventing them from either they might end up being homeless. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that I've done is instead of creating that, a friend of mine named Lisa Glow is the CEO of CAS, Central Arizona Shelter Services. She asked me to be a board member. So I was able to, you know, utilize CAS as kind of a stepping stone for what we want to do with, you know, serious mental illness, SMI. It's been amazing. So I ended up being the chairman of CAS for, you know, we do the homeless shelters. Mm-hmm. We've created some other communities, not just in downtown Phoenix, but in other locations. And now we're actually really focusing on an SMI location so we can help with that. The things
now,
that,
what will be different about an SMI location as opposed to a homeless shelter?
Well, let me explain that.
Yeah.
Okay. And I have this, I preach this to so many people. There's a difference between homeless and transient. Homeless person doesn't decide to be homeless, doesn't want to be homeless. 60% of Americans are one paycheck away from being homeless. If you guys think about even your own past, mm-hmm. there was times you're like, oh, shit, lost my job. Mom, dad, can I move in or whatever, right? Or you're mm-hmm. trying to find a friend to live with. The transient population doesn't mean they're homeless. And by the way, homeless people doesn't mean they're not employed. We have a lot of working homeless.
Sure.
So, but the transient population, when somebody was standing on the side of the road begging for money and stuff, and someone goes, did you see that homeless person? Blah, blah, blah. You're like, not necessarily homeless. They may have a home. They, you know, there's some other perspective associated with why they're out there doing what they're doing. Some of them just make money that way. Mm-hmm. Some of them have addictions, just got out of prison, mm-hmm. you know, and these are people I think we can help. What is happening now is there's a criminal element that's moved into the transient population, not mm-hmm. the homeless population, but people seem to think that when they see a person, they're homeless when they may not be. Mm-hmm. The criminal element is hiding in there, and they're selling drugs, they're selling people, they're selling sex, they're selling whatever. Blueies, we call them blueies now. These are the people that can buy the $2 fentanyl pill on mm-hmm. the side of the road mm-hmm. at most of your bus stops listening. I hope cities are listening. That we see it all the time. They sell a $2 bluey, which is a fentanyl pill. It's blue with some tinfoil, and you just heat it up. 3 hours, you're like on cloud nine, and once you come down and stuff, and it really destroys your life, then you're out, you're homeless. You know, you're on the street. Mm-hmm. So what I wanted to do with this SMI thing, or this mental health, mental illness, mental disorder, is to try to separate the homeless population from the transient population, start really focusing on the individuals. I mean, there's people who have gotten out of prison. They can't get jobs, but they're great people. Yep. They've served their time. Give them a chance. I don't know. There's this thing called St. Joseph the Worker. Mm-hmm. You know, this. If you meet anybody that needs help, send them down to the HSC, the Human Service Campus, and let them meet with St. Joseph the Worker, and they can most likely find a job, you know. But we need to separate the criminal element out of the transient element. The transient, you know, we can try to help them with anxiety, depression, schizophrenia, which is a huge one, bipolar. Like, a lot of these, we can try to help them. Mm. But you know, you have to have cash to really see a psychiatrist anymore.
Oh, there's a novel.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my goal was to try to have all these psychiatrists that would actually donate help for a bottle of, I'm not going to say Xanax, but any like SSRI. So like a Zoloft.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
$7. But if we can help people get over their anxiety or their depression and help them get where they can go back to getting a job, you know, and
right.
I would be happy to pay $7 a person for up to, you know, 7,000 or 1,000 people or something, right? I mean, it's like you can give that person that little step to get to the next level. The population of the United States is what?
Was it 300 and some million?
Is that right?
Yep, about 330 million. Mm-hmm. The adult population in the United States is, I think out of the adult population, what was it I read? Was it 60% of the adult population? Oh, I'm not even going to spit the numbers out. Let's just say there's a huge number that have been diagnosed with mental health, mental illness, mental disorder. Diagnosed, all right? Remember, you got to have cash to see a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. That's 50 million people. Okay, 50 million out of 330. How many of those do you think have not been diagnosed?
Oh, yeah.
Double.
That's
maybe?
That's a staggering number.
Yeah. Triple?
Yeah.
So now you're talking about 100 to 150 million adults that potentially have some sort of mental illness, mental health, mental disorder. We're not even talking about the children yet. You throw the children in there. Do you think it's 3/4 of the United States, 2/3 of the United States. You know what I'm saying? Like, you just think about it. Like, I don't have to tell you numbers, but you know, mm-hmm. There's three of us sitting at the table. I know one of us has to take drugs for anxiety. I'm dead serious. Mm-hmm. If I don't take Zoloft, I can't function worth a shit. I start to sweat. My tongue swells
I've
up.
I've got friends that do the same thing. Yep.
You know, so that's one out of three of us. And who knows? One of you might also take something. So, The point is that you know, there's so many of our population that are dealing with this, right?
Yeah.
We got to do something about it. The good news is we're starting to see people wanting to do something about it. And CAS, Central Arizona Shelter Services, has been starting to move in that direction as well. So if they ever ask you for money, please give them money, because it's for a really good cause. It's to help people and families, kids. Oh, it's like what we do for children and families is amazing. So,
well, I'm glad we asked the question.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've just been sitting here going, you know, no, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a problem we're having. I mean, all over the world right now, all over our nation mostly. So,
We got to do something.
Got to do something.
Got to start with somebody.
Just got to start with somebody. JJ?
What else you got? got another short story yet?
Like all kinds of short stories.
Hold up. I have one. So what's next for Carl? What's the next nearest chapter for Carl?
So I've really gotten back into cars.
Uh-oh.
So my father, he's a big car guy, and I grew up with cars, like Chevys. Like I owned like 19 Camaros and Lord knows how many Blazers and Novas and stuff. So I've gotten back into cars, and I have some really fun cars. So I'm kind of starting to do this little thing.
Are you into restoring them, or what do you?
Everything.
Okay.
So I have an eight second quarter mile car that I have sitting in my garage. It's a 2012 Copo Camaro with a 327 with a 4.0 Whipple on it. And the thing puts out a few hundred horsepower, like a lot of horsepower. So we'll do 888 and quarter mile at 150 miles per hour. I have a fun little Boss 302 with twin Hellion turbos. It's a track car. This thing is a Laguna Seca car. Super fun. And I just bought a 1963 Nova Super Sport convertible. It's so beautiful. And the car drives like a dream. And I got
already restored.
Already restored. Yeah. I sometimes it's cheaper to buy them already restored.
Yeah.
I've got a little cool little short box, a square body short box truck with a brand new crate motor in it. My dad got me. It's just so fun to drive. Like, just some fun cars. I have some very fun cars. And my son he's 16. He'll be 17.
Danger.
So he's really getting into cars. And I think that's what really transpired me to start doing the car things. So I used to race all the time. I used to do so much, always at the tracks and stuff. And, you know, I was so focused on engineering and building a business that I forgot my roots. And my neighbor has a really nice little Mustang. He had a problem with one of his push rods broke. And I was like, well, it's been a while since I tore one of these apart.
But
it was awesome. We tore it apart in minutes. We fixed it in another few minutes. Reset all the lifters on that thing. And I was like, yes, I still remember this stuff.
Yeah.
So my next step is, you know, I'm still going to work for Ardora, still help them grow. I'm having the time of my life with it. Still wanting to do a lot of stuff with the homeless and also with the mental health and illness and disorder. And I've been dabbling with a lot of development lately as a developer myself.
Yeah. Good for you.
And now when I retire, I want to have something to play with.
I think we know an engineer we can give him a referral to.
We do. We could
look in the mirror. John, can you hire? Yeah. As John's listening, or maybe he will. That's too funny.
Well, it was great having you on.
Oh, this is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah,
We didn't have to say two words.
No, we talked about it, and I said, I don't know anything about Carl. He's like, don't worry about it. Like,
I said, just get Carl on here. He's a personality in itself. He'll just take it.
Very cool.
We could have like 2 or 3 hours with you.
Yeah, great discussion.
Well, thanks for a number of things. One, being an engineer, being a capitalist, being a philanthropist, I think, is the other part that I think a lot of people here probably now listen to.
Yeah.
So continue to do good things in our community. We appreciate you.
I appreciate you saying that.
We'll have you on again.
Okay.
Okay. Get us out of here, Sean.
You've been listening to the Mac and Blue Show, brought to you by Tory Contracting and Blue Wave General Contracting. Be sure to subscribe to the Mac and Blue podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Follow Robert Johnson and JJ Levinsky on LinkedIn and Instagram. Tune in live every first and third Thursday at 3 p.m. as we continue to introduce you to the people building Arizona. Walt Disney said, "You can dream, create, design, and build the most wonderful place in the world, but it requires people to make the dream a reality." Until next time, make it a great day.